Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for you all today. My guests will be Dr. Monica Agrawal and Dr. Jyoti Rao. And together, they wrote a new book that I'm really excited to share with you called Body on Fire, How Inflammation Triggers Chronic Illness and the Tools We Have to Fight It. But of course, before we get to our guests, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news, share with you some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first off, we are all witnessing some crazy times here in the country. We have such divide in this country. It's just really, really so disturbing. And it doesn't seem like it's going to be coming together anytime in the near future. You know, things that seem so obvious to me are not so obvious to half of the country. You know, I just don't understand how people can support the person we have in the White House. And yet there obviously are many people that still think he's a great person. So we need to figure out ways to come together. We need to try to have understanding and compassion, try to listen to the other side so that we can try to understand and promote more love and compassion in our communities. We need to care about the things that are important. And I know most of my listeners here, I'm preaching to the choir. So, you know, but every week when I write my newsletter and I ask you to sign these petitions, part of me feels like it's so trivial with what's going on, you know, asking the Biden administration to support clean water. Of course, that's important. But meanwhile, we have people storming the Capitol. So we really need to find ways that we can promote love in our own communities and take care of our own health and spread the word of goodness everywhere we go, and try to be beacons of love in our communities, because that's what the world needs right now. There's just so much hate and anger, and it's just so sad, just so sad. There's nothing else I can really say about that. You know, one of the things I asked you to do to take action this week was to tell the Biden administration that everybody in this country, everybody on the whole planet, but let's worry about our country right now, is entitled to safe, accessible water. And right now, I mean, Flint still doesn't have clean water. You know, there's so many communities that don't have access to clean water. And there's, you know, an estimated 15 million people who might experience water shutoffs right now because water is not one of the exempt utilities that is being covered under the COVID safeguards. So we need to really push the Biden administration. I know the Biden administration is looking to expand the COVID pandemic related safeguards. And so hopefully that will be coming, but we need to let them know that water, it needs to really be up there at the top of the list. Everyone needs access to good, clean, and healthy water. And we really, on another note, want to stop just buying bottled water. I mean, you know, to have towns depend on bottled water is just ridiculous, because we know there's no place to put all that plastic that we are accumulating. So we really need to do that. Another thing that I asked you to sign, a petition for the Biden administration to reverse the roadless rule that Trump has exempted the Tongass forest from. That's the Tongass National Forest up in Alaska. And it's one of the largest carbon sinks, or it is the largest carbon sink in North America. And as any of you who've been following me knows, we need as many of these carbon sinks as possible to try to mitigate climate change. And right now they are not protecting this national forest. And this forest is also also really important to the Alaska Native tribes that live in that area. They have a lot of interest in that area, and the destruction of that forest is disrupting a lot of their own ancestral lands. So please sign that petition as well. It's really, really important. Another thing I shared was an article that I saw this week in the New York Times about coconut oil. And I'm sure we can talk more about this when my guests come on. But years ago, when I first became a vegetarian, I was told that coconut was not healthy. Coconut oil wasn't healthy. Coconut milk wasn't healthy. And I don't know how many years ago, but many years ago, we started hearing that coconut oil was healthy. And now this article in the New York Times is now saying it's not healthy. So that's really, really important. And you should all read this article. Marion Nessel, who is a food scientist from NYU, she is really, really essential in getting the word out. So you should all check that out as well. So let's see what else. I want to share with you my recipe this week, which is Mexican wedding cookies. They're vegan and gluten-free. And I'm sorry, just 1 minute. I think my guest is having trouble getting on. So I just want to make sure that she has the link to our Zoom so that she can join us in just a little bit. So the Mexican wedding cookies, this is a traditional cookie that you will see at weddings all over Mexico. I have reformulated it to make it vegan and gluten-free. It still uses, I use an organic powdered sugar, but you can try substituting maple syrup with it. I've done that and that works as well. So I substituted butter. For the butter, I'm using canola oil. So a half a cup of organic canola oil. You need to make sure it's organic, because otherwise canola oil is all GMO'd. So you need to make sure it's organic. A half a cup of organic canola oil, a half a cup of tahini, 2 tablespoons of either organic powdered sugar or the maple syrup, 1 teaspoon of vanilla, 2 cups of gluten-free flour, and 1 cup of finely chopped walnuts. And you're going to just mix the oils together, the canola oil and the tahini, with the powdered sugar. And I just want to tell you ahead of time that these cookies are not sweet at all. Like I'm saying, there's only 2 tablespoons of sugar in the whole recipe, or 2 tablespoons of maple syrup. Then you're going to add the vanilla, mix that in, then add the gluten-free flour and the walnuts and combine that well. And then I used a small cookie scooper, or you can just hand roll it, and you want them to be about the size of walnuts. You're going to make little balls out of them, lay them out onto a well-greased cookie sheet, and then press them down with a fork just so they get little ridges on the top. You're going to bake them for 10 to 15 minutes, depending on your stove. I always have to turn my cookie sheet around halfway through because the back of my oven is hotter than the front of my oven. And then let them cool just a little bit, but while they're still warm, you're going to drop them into a bag of powdered sugar and shake it, and then take them out. And so that's what gives them the sweetness. I also tried making it with all tahini. I used a cup of tahini instead of any canola oil. And that worked really well too, but it was more like halva. Do you know what that is? That's like sesame paste, sweetened. And it was really delicious, but it was much more pasty with using just tahini as opposed to cutting it with the canola oil. So that's why I cut it with the canola oil. But they're delicious. As with all sweets, they are a treat. They're not something to eat all the time. But when you do want them, they really have a nice place to, as a treat. So enjoy those. As always, I love hearing from all of you. Give me feedback if you make them. If you make any changes to the recipe and improve on them, please share those with me too. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guests, Dr. Monica Agrawal and Dr. Jyoti Rao. And together they wrote this new book called Body on Fire, How Inflammation Triggers Chronic Illness and the Tools We Have to Fight It. And Dr. Monica Agrawal is an associate professor of medicine in the University of Florida in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine. And she serves as the Director of Integrative Cardiology and Prevention at the University of Florida. And she focuses on promoting food as the foundation of healing and for its medicinal value. She's also the Director of Medical Education for Cardiology, where she directs education for medical residents and cardiology fellows, with a focus on prevention, nutrition, and lifestyle. In the hospital, she has multiple initiatives, including developing a 100% plant-based menu for cardiac and vascular patients. Amazing. Can't wait to talk about that. And Dr. Agrawal believes gives talks around the community and the country. And she was named the Next Generation Innovator by Cardiology Today. She conducts research on nutrition education in medical institutions and on how plant-based diet impacts cardiovascular disease. She's board certified in cardiology, echocardiography, nuclear cardiology, and she's a fellow of the American College of Cardiology, where she's a member of the Nutrition Council working on nutrition policies for the nation. Monica specializes in preventative management of heart disease with lifestyle techniques in conjunction with medications. In addition to Body on Fire, she's also the author of a book called Finding Balance, Empower Yourself with Tools to Combat Stress and Illness, which outlines 10 prescriptions to help guide people to better health. And Dr. Jyoti Rao has been practicing medicine for over 20 years. She received her doctorate of medicine from the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey and completed her internship and residency at the prestigious New England Medical Center in Boston. Before opening her center called Shakti Health and Wellness Center, Dr. Rao practiced medicine in New York and Maryland. She's also a strong proponent of holistic medicine, and she's certified in medical acupuncture as well as cardiopulmonary stress testing, which is a personalized assessment of cardiac and pulmonary disease. And so it's my pleasure to introduce both of them to you. Dr. Monica and Jyoti, are you with me?
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, we can't see you, by the way.
No, this is just audio.
Oh, okay.
This is just audio. We're working towards doing the video ones, but we're not there yet. So
no problem.
Now we're just the radio. Okay. So I'm loving your book. It's right up my alley. I am, you know, mostly plant-based myself, so I'm just loving it. Can you share with us your story? I know I have both of you on, so I don't know who wants to start first. Let's say Dr. Monica, would you like to start first?
Sure. Maybe the best way is for you to just sort of ask us who you want to speak, so we don't, you know, we give equal time.
Sure. Okay. So how did you come to writing this book, and what is your story? How'd you come to food as medicine, which is so different than most doctors?
Yeah. So thanks. Thanks for, first of all, for having us on the show. It's nice to be here. So, a cardiologist by training. I've been in practice now for over 10 years. When I was always interested in nutrition and lifestyle, I did the integrative medicine fellowship at the University of Arizona while I was a cardiology fellow. So I was always interested in the concept that there's other ways to heal the body than just medication. But admittedly, when I went into practice, I gave out a load of prescriptions. Cholesterol medicines called statins were daily things that I was giving out to most of my patients. Getting started on medications was just part of the clinical visit. It was, you know, only after feeling like a couple things happen, you feel like you're not really making people better which is one of the things that was probably hard to see, is that you keep giving people medicine, but you're maybe making things worse or just not making things better. And that leaves a very unsatisfying feeling. It really changed for me, however, when I got sick myself. And that is how outlined in the first chapters of the book, where we talk about my illness. And so within, after I had my third child, I went quickly from being sort of an athlete and very active to becoming completely immobilized. You know, I was very limited, and when my joints were all hurt and didn't move properly. So within a very short amount of time after the baby was born to the point that I got sick was just a couple of months. And I went from being this active runner to really being unable to climb the stairs. It's moments like that, I think, that kind of define our lives and define us, because they are deep, dark moments. And you got to try to figure out how to get out of that hole. I was diagnosed with advanced rheumatoid arthritis. I was told that I would be on medications for the rest of my life. I was told that I just had to deal with that reality rather than thinking that there were alternatives. And the sooner that I realized that, the better I would do. Those are humbling, hopeless feelings and things that I had to learn and that's sort of how I, as a physician myself, I sort of said, okay, this is what I have to do and I'll do what I need to do. And so I got on medications. I had very significant side effects from them. My hair fell out. I lost a lot of weight. And it's in those moments that you think, God, there's got to be another way. And it was only at that time that I really started learning, mostly because somebody hit me on the head with it and sort of said, hey, you know, your diet sucks. I'm like, well, what do you mean my diet sucks? Like, I eat well. When you start learning about the role of diet and how it changes and how that could actually change your response to inflammation, it changes you. And it did. It changed everything for me. And so that started me on a path towards learning about how your lifestyle can change how you respond to illness and how you can heal. Mm-hmm. I think the thing to remember is that, you know, we're all going to get something, you know, we're all going to get some illness. We're all going to get sick somehow. We all have a genetic history that we can't change. You can't change your parents. But how we respond to that illness, how our body expresses the illness, and then how our bodies express and what we do and the tools we use to heal our bodies are really what define how we're going to do in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Jyoti, what about you? Do you have a similar experience?
So my journey to this has been more about frustration with, I'm sorry, I'm on like two different versions here, so I don't know how to stop it. Can you guys see me okay?
Well, we're not seeing you, but we're hearing you.
Okay, sorry. My frustration was being an internist out of a residency program that taught us a lot about how each organ, you know, works individually and not together. So when I started practicing initially, it was very frustrating for me as an internist to kind of deal with things that are, multifocal in terms of people's fatigue or constipation or just general medicine issues. I just felt supremely frustrated. So I was looking for answers and how I can offer my patients tools. So my journey has been more about kind of trying to find resources for myself to heal and kind of just go through aging better, have more energy, work more efficiently. But also for my patients, I was kind of tired of just writing scripts and sending people to specialists to get things done. And I became an acupuncturist very early on in my career, and I kind of opened up all my doors of healing concept versus Band-Aid concepts. So that's kind of been my journey to try to find all these things that affect our immune system, that affect the way we age, that affect the way we can connect our mind and body, because I found over 24 years of practice that nothing is in isolation. So everything's related, and ultimately we have more control than we think we have over our health.
Absolutely. And how did you find each other?
So that's a great story. So a mutual friend, but it turned out we both met, I think, after Monica had her second baby. We were out to dinner together and we just happened to be sitting together next to each other. But it turns out that we actually were both trained at New England Medical Center several years apart. I didn't know her then, but we actually had the same background training, which set us up for, I think, a similar path.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So going back to you, Dr. Monica, is it okay for me to call you by your first names? Is that
all
right?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. So what was recommended to you to heal your inflammation, or did they even call it inflammation when they were telling you had advanced rheumatoid arthritis?
So the rheumatologist just gave me a bunch of pills and said that I needed to take them, check my liver. I mean, the worst part of that is, you know, I had to stop nursing my baby. And anyone who's ever nursed a kid knows that that's a very personal and important time. And I had to stop because the medications would be toxic to the baby. So, you know, I had to stop nursing within a week of my diagnosis, and so that I could start medication. Did they call it inflammation? You know, I think that most autoimmune diseases are considered inflammatory, but our full understanding of inflammation has really evolved in the last 10 years and continues to evolve. And we're really understanding more that most illnesses are triggered by inflammation. And I think that that's not something that was fully understood and continues to it's being learned about more fully now. So yeah, I got a bunch of pills. I was sent home and said, see you in 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the medical profession so often does that. My father-in-law, who's 96 and super healthy right now, but he had an incident back in the fall. And they said, you know, they said it was like a mini stroke. They sent him home with oxygen and a walker and said, this is your new normal. And so he really thought that was it. He was going to be on oxygen and walker for the rest of his life. And one of the visiting nurses said, you don't have to be, it's up to you. You know, it's like if you want to get back to exercising, you can. And within a few months, it's amazing. I mean, no walker, no oxygen. He's 96 sharp. And, you know, he really thought they sent him home to die. I mean, that was really the message. And,
sad. It is sad. It's not that physicians, to be fair, you know, we're as physicians, you know, I work in a hospital, I work with residents and fellows every day. And it's not that they don't want people to do well. And that's important. I mean, we want as physicians, that's the goal. That's what we're taught. We want people to do well. It's just that we as physicians aren't taught these other tools about the importance of empowering patients and how to give people hope. Like, I think that was maybe the biggest lesson I learned from my illness is how important it is to give people hope, because I was never given any hope. I had 3 miscarriages as well before I had my first child, sort of another story. Mm-hmm. And I remember that same feeling is that they never give you hope that you could do better. They always say to you, well, this is just the way it is. And I think that if I learned anything from my experiences with now 3 miscarriages, a chronic illness, is that people need to feel hope. And they can, because when you give them that hope, then the next step is empowering them with tools. But if you don't have that hopefulness and that optimism, you almost can't make that next step.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So, what was your first step to regaining your health?
My first step to regaining my health was, so I got on all the medications I was told to take. You know, I had wicked side effects. And then I met this nurse, a nutritionist, and she sort of telling me that my diet wasn't very good. And I couldn't understand how that was possible. I was already vegetarian, but I was eating and drinking a lot of milk. So I started by eliminating all dairy. And that was super altering for me. I mean, it was life altering, cutting out dairy. But I didn't just eliminate. I think the adding back in whole foods, which I hadn't really understood the importance of a processed food versus a whole food. I mean, you understand it in concept, but then when you you think, oh yeah, that makes sense. But most people think they're eating actually quite well. I think that that's a disconnect. And then sort of understanding that the whole food is different than what you're getting in these packages takes some learning. And then also learning how to, that this all impacts your gut, which I think is the key thing, is understanding that what you eat affects your gut, which then affects how your body will respond to inflammation. And that connection between the gut and the gut, that is a gut inflammation concept, is a very novel concept and really something that's only been learned and understood over the last 10 years and not arguably fully understood.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Dr. Jyoti, for you, what do you see as some of the triggers for inflammation? What foods do you recommend to your patients?
You know, I think it's interesting when I ask people, what's your diet like? Most people say, oh, I eat well. And then when you tease it out, you see, you know, processed foods after processed foods. A lot of the problems, I think, are people don't know how to read labels. And the newer labels are a little bit better, but the sugar content in foods is so ridiculously high. The salt content is so high. The preservatives are so high that it takes a good nutritious food and then combines it with all of these other things that makes it a poor food, which is why the whole food concept is so important. So I oftentimes start with just going over what a carb, protein, and a fat is with people. I start by talking about fiber, because to me, that is really the key, is to add back the foods that are going to grow our good bacteria in our gut. It's not often enough to, you know, to eat well. You have to also process foods, the animal fats, the saturated fats, the animal products in general. And people cry because they don't want to give up their cheese and they don't want to give up, you know, I have people, grown-ups, crying about, what am I going to put in my coffee? You know, so it's this struggle of where do I start? There's so much we can do with food, but I oftentimes start with the elimination of it and adding back fiber. And when I say eliminate, I mean eliminate sugars, which is in everything. And I encourage people to start looking at labels and to read what added sugar means, or, you know, total carbohydrates, what does the fiber mean in it? And so we sit there and we discuss all of that initially so that they can get a handle on it, because ultimately I want them to make better choices and I don't want to give them a diet food plan that's just so limiting for them. So kind of more expanding what the concepts are so that we can get rid of the bad, add back the good, and start looking at the foods that you're purchasing, even if it's some, you know, frozen foods aren't bad all the time. Frozen berries and frozen fruits are not bad, but it's one of those things like people have struggle with, how much am I going to do in a day? I don't have time for this. That's kind of the, where people are just worried about initially.
Mm-hmm. And this can be for either of you. If you, can you talk a little bit how genetically modified foods affect your gut? Because there's a lot of, you know, I know I've heard of many doctors putting their patients on GMO-free diets because people don't realize how much those preservatives are actually affecting our gut. Would one of you like to take that on?
I'll start. I'm not 100% sure about that topic. And I'm not sure that we should say for sure that GMO foods are bad. So I appreciate that modification isn't optimal in many cases. You know, for instance, I'm not sure that we should be genetically modifying some foods and that they have been correlated with more inflammation. And so I think that there's, but at the same time, the way that the society is growing, we don't almost have enough food without genetic modification. So I'm not saying that I think that we should be eating genetically modified food, but I'm also not sure that we have, in some ways, some choices will be taken away with the way our food sources are. I think the thing to really follow is listen to your body. And I think that's a lot of things what many people are haven't learned or have forgotten how to do, to sort of see how your body reacts to certain foods. So I do believe that some genetically modified foods can trigger inflammation, and that's very important. And so it's very important to understand which of those foods triggers inflammation in you. But I think that also some people don't have resources to get non-GMO. And so I don't want to throw it out completely, because I think that there's going to be a role for GMO foods. And what that role is, I don't know yet. And to what level, I think, is also important. I mean, there's so much modification. Sometimes I'm not sure that it has the same integrity it does when it started. Those foods are probably worse than foods that have some slight alterations. I just want to be mindful that there's a that our society and our population is 4 billion or 7 billion people. And feeding 7 billion people often requires some genetic modification. I'm not saying it's right, but I do see that some of that is, I'm not sure we can get away from all genetic modifications. So I just don't wanna make it a hard stop, because I think that that would make it really hard for some people.
The two foods in my practice that I've seen be very aggravating that are genetically modified is soy and corn, which tends to be very inflammatory, creating an itis, like more, a lot of more asthma, eczema, inflammation. So that those are two that I often trigger a target in my practice to make sure that people are at least aware of
that. Seeing these we're going to take a couple minute break.
When we come back, I'd like to talk about spices, because that, you know, people don't think very often as spices as being medicinal at all. And for many, in many cultures, they really are, and they're a key. And so I'd love to come back and talk a little bit about that, especially as a chef. So don't go anywhere, everyone. Be right back. You're listening to Bhavani at iegreen.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Monica Agrawal and Dr. Jyoti Rao, and we're talking about food and inflammation and how diets affect our body. Their new book, Body on Fire, How Inflammation Triggers Chronic Illness and the Tools We Have to Fight It, is a wonderful book that I recommend to all of you. And right before the break, I was asking them about spices and how spices affect our diet. Dr. Rao, you want to take that one on?
Sure. So spices were one of the reasons that Dr. Agrawal and I connected. Initially, we were kind of kindred spirits in our search to find tools for our patients with hypertension, cardiovascular issues. You know, what can we do instead of salt? And one of the ways we met initially was in my home. I had a cooking class for other physicians where we were trying to use we started with a lot of Indian spices to try to flavor food, because one of my patients started asking me when I first began this journey, a young couple whose wife sat down with me, and she said, well, if I can't have salt, how am I going to flavor my food? And so it was a question I didn't know the answer to. I really was struggling with that, so I didn't really know too much. But when I started looking into spices, and we did this cooking class together, all the physicians, you know, we all started getting excited about it. And there's so much ways to flavor the food. I think there's an intimidation about spices. And so spices are so valuable because they're powerful antioxidants and powerful anti-inflammatories packed in a tiny little package, because you don't need a whole lot. Remember that, wars were fought over spices. They can be very medicinal. They can help with sugar control, like cinnamon, for example, is a great sugar control aid. So I talked often my patients with insulin resistance and diabetes to start putting cinnamon in water and foods and just put it on things to help the insulin resistance. It's also great. Turmeric is one of our favorites. It's a wonderful anti-inflammatory. It helps clear the gut inflammation as well, and CRP lowering. And it's got a lot of data to show some benefit in whole body health. So that's one of the ones that I have people start, you know, at least putting it in their food. The other great spices like, rosemary and marjoram are part of the Mediterranean diet that, you know, really add some benefit for antioxidation and anti-inflammatory for cardiovascular health. We talk about ginger, which is a great antiemetic. It's great for nausea. I have mostly everyone start putting it in water. I have turmeric, and I ask people to start making teas, which are, you know, a great way to add spices without trying to, you know, worry about, you know, I don't know how to cook with these. I'm so nervous about it. It starts to get people a little agitated. But I think if you start small, if you start with adding one or two into your dishes and started to add it into your teas, for example, you can make wonderful teas. I love making yogi tea, which has cardamom and cloves. Cloves are incredible, and they're the most powerful antioxidant out there. And cloves have such potential to change inflammation in our body. So a few cloves, cardamom, turmeric, black pepper, which is often needed to make the turmeric activated. Cinnamon in a tea form, even with or without black tea, can be a wonderful kind of rejuvenating drink for people. So there's a lot of ways to start with spices, and it's a great medicinal tool, which you can start throwing in. So I think I would encourage people to just grab five, grab seven of them and start experimenting, putting it in your dishes, but also start adding it to your beverages, because that's a simple way to go.
Yeah. I start every day with, you know, some water with turmeric and black pepper. Like you said, I put a little ginger in there and a two drops of my vitamin D, which I've been told I have to add. So, you know, that's my morning drink.
Yeah. Oftentimes our mornings too.
With apple cider vinegar, of course.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I have my apple cider vinegar in there.
Yeah. No, so it's an underused area of you know, we have a medicine chest in our kitchen. You know, there's definitely a lot of value in these spices.
And what about fresh cilantro? I've heard that's really
So herbs,
an antioxidant too.
They're antioxidants, but cilantro and parsley are also great for detoxification. They're great for hormone balance. Especially we have a lot of hormone imbalance in women that tends to be more estrogen dominant, and our bodies can't clear estrogen as well because sometimes the liver is just overworked. And so cilantro and parsley are great spices to add for detoxification and hormone balance.
Wow. Great. Great. What about nightshade vegetables? Do you talk about those at all in your practice? To, you know, some people say nightshade vegetables affect inflammation. And so, you know, I know in macrobiotics, you know, they avoid nightshades. What's your feeling on nightshades?
I'll start with that one. There is a subset of patients with autoimmune disease and sometimes with osteoarthritis and inflammation in the joints that are susceptible to nightshades, but the whole class, and I would hesitate to tell everyone who has an autoimmune disease or inflammation or arthritis to say no nightshades, because it is really an individual issue. Nightshades have an acid that basically can have an inflammatory effect, but just like everything else, it's very independent on the person, but it's such a group of vegetables, peppers and eggplant and potatoes that we don't want to exclude tomatoes across the board for people. We just really think that it has to be personalized. So I do talk about nightshades as a potential for patients who are still in pain, even though we have done many different things. I refer to gluten that way as well. It's not bad for everyone, but in a subset of patients, it can be inflammatory. So we do have to try to kind of go broad strokes, but I oftentimes don't like to pull off plant-based foods in large areas without kind of tailoring it to each individual.
That makes sense. And Dr. Monica, what, besides diet, what other lifestyle changes do you recommend for your patients to improve their medical situations or their health?
So I think the thing to remember is that most of our bodies are highly inflamed and irritated. And most of that's because we are, we're overstimulated all the time. And so if you think about just in terms of the nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system is our fight or flight. That's what it's called. What we call it in medicine is the fight or flight response. So like if you have to pick up your baby or your baby's been sick or you're running to catch them because they're going to fall, you are faster, your vision is acute, your hearing is acute, you're not thinking about how you have to go to the bathroom or you're hungry because all of those systems shut off and you focus on elevated heart rate and get going so you can do what you need to do. And then there's the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and digest or rest and recover, which then after you've had that sort of high intensity moment, then you get into your recovery. Most of us in our society, I would argue, maybe obviously not everyone, but many people are very shifted towards sympathetic a higher sympathetic tone just because of all the things we do. We don't allow ourselves, we're on our phones, we're eating when we're standing, we're not sitting down and eating the meal comfortably. Our phones are ringing all the time. We're running here and there, dropping kids off here, there. I mean, just, it's a constant, and we're not allowing ourselves to recover. In fact, I used to think it was a badge of how cool and great I was that I didn't sleep but 4 hours a night. And I would say, I don't only need 4 hours of sleep a night. And how sad that is, that it was a badge of honor that I didn't need sleep. And I think that that's the saddest part, is that we celebrate people who can do more. And we've forgotten to celebrate people who do less. And doing less is actually something to be admired and honored, because so much of what we just don't take that time to rest and recover, and our bodies become out of balance. And so when you ask about what other things we focus on besides nutrition is a huge aspect, but you know, one of the things that was my biggest weakness, Jyothi would tell you, is that I never used to sleep. And learning to sleep 8-9 hours, an average adult should sleep between 7 and 9 hours a night. And we really focus, I focus on that in my life, and I really focus on that with my patients. But not just that, I mean, emotional stress is a big problem in our society now. And sort of that's work stress, that's stress from family, and sort of working on calming the mind. People tell me they can't fall asleep at night, or their heart rates are always elevated. Why are their heart rates always 80 beats a minute? I mean, that's a fast heart rate. I really would want to see patients' heart rates in the 60s and 70s, or even in the 60s and 50s. Why is it so high all the time? And so how can we calm that down? Or why kept people having trouble sleeping? And so teaching patients how to breathe, learning how to calm their mind, how to meditate, how to do things that stretch the body, like yoga, that focus on concentration, Tai Chi. These are sort of really nice skills to teach. In my clinic, I have yoga mats, and patients are known to be in the hallways stretching out and learning how to move their bodies just in the clinic, because I do emphasize the need for movement, stretch, focus, concentration, and meditation and sleep, which are super important tools to allowing your body to recover, and remembering and telling people, yeah, it's okay to do less, to honor that their body needs to recover.
Mm-hmm. This is another question for you as well, since I know you still are working in a hospital, and Dr. Jyothi, you have the privilege of having your own health center, so you can kind of call your shots. But for you, Dr. Monica, working in a large medical institution, how do they relate to you or welcome your path of trying to heal people through diet? Because I've been doing my show for over 10 years here, and I've interviewed so many doctors who, like yourselves, are trying to promote healthy lifestyle changes, which has to do with diet. And as a result, very often you actually heal people. You're not just covering the symptoms, but you're actually making people healthy again, which means they're not on medication and they're not having the surgeries. And so, you know, I had Dr. Joel Kahn on, who, you know, ran a big cardio center in Detroit, and basically was let go because he wasn't bringing in enough business. He was getting everybody healthy, and so they were doing less surgeries, and the hospital was not pleased. So how does your hospital relate to your path of actually trying to heal people as opposed to just doing surgeries and medication?
I think hospitals are in a difficult situation, in the sense that most the way insurance works, it's such a complex issue, and that I just hate to call one person the enemy. The hospital systems are forced to take insurance from companies, and insurance companies and Medicare, they focus on acuity-based care rather than value-based care. So the sicker the patient, the more they get reimbursed. And so the way patient care works nowadays is that if you are sicker and then you have to arrange a procedure, the hospital gets more money. So it's a totally dysfunctional system at multiple levels, right? So it's not that one person's to blame. It's just that we've learned to honor and support taking care of high risk and high acuity. And so that paradigm has to shift. And so I think hospitals are learning this and trying to understand this, and insurance companies are slowly trying to understand that focusing more on prevention is better for them, as they're starting to see that actually supporting gym memberships and dietitians, and as they're starting slowly to approve and cover those things, we're seeing a shift. Being in a big hospital system, yeah, it's been hard and weird for them to have me there. I would tell you that when I first got to University of Florida, they probably were just not sure what to do with me. But I think what I impress upon people is that my job and goal is to heal people with multimodality, which means that I want to use medications when medications are needed, and I want to use lifestyle tools when lifestyle tools are needed. And many times it requires both. And I will tell you that in my clinic, I take care of many physicians, and I take care of many deans and people from the senior administration come to my clinic. And I think that speaks volumes to the fact that while we as people are looking for an approach that involves self-healing, and slowly I'm hoping and I'm seeing a little bit of shift nationally. It's just going to take a lot more time where we start focusing on sort of that value-based concept rather than acuity. So yeah, it is hard, but it's a challenge that I enjoy, and I respect the process and I'm not afraid of it. And so as I have introduced the plant-based menu at University of Florida, they were shocked that it was effective and successful, and it was financially not a burden, and that people wanted it. And I think those kind of affirming moments make hospitals more inclined to support the programs that I introduce.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm happy to hear that, because, you know, mostly that's not what I'm hearing. You know, mostly I'm hearing, you know, hospitals really want you to, you know, promote the medications and the surgeries, because like you said, that's how they get paid. And as you said, the system is really broken, and that's something that, you know, we need to work on. But when so much money is wrapped up in medicine, it's really, really hard.
Yeah, so. I think pioneers and people that are willing to sort of put in the time to grow their hospital systems is what it's going to take. And I think that's going to be the key, is that just people coming up, like you mentioned, all these physicians that you're interviewing, and slowly they are becoming champions and pioneers that they're in their systems, and slowly the system will have to change.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Jyoti, you want to talk a little bit how in your practice you're able to recommend diet or, you know, some of these lifestyle changes for your patients, and how that has been helpful for them?
Yeah, so my practice, you know, relies heavily on change. People have to be willing to change. I was working in a different practice where I was seeing 25, 30 people with a 15-minute visit. And I changed my practice about 8 years ago because there's just no time to talk to people about change. But what also my practice has done now is it kind of has motivated the people who want to do lifestyle changes, don't want to rely on meds and just surgeries and prescriptions all the time for their therapies. They want to learn more. My initial appointment's 90 minutes usually to try to review all of the things that people have in their control. When you walk into my practice, there's a kitchen. And pre-COVID, we would be having cooking classes and teaching people about spices and all of these other things. So now, because of COVID, there's a lot of restrictions, but I spend a lot of time talking about the power of the gut. And I talk about the gut for the microbiome issue, which it gives us 3 million genes, how we're 10%, we're 23,000 genes ourselves, and we have to, you know, succumb to these bacteria, which are really the powerhouse of us, and we got to treat them well. We got to nurture them, and that's through food, and our choices matter. And so I spend a lot of time on that. And we talk about the elimination diet, and we talk about adding back fiber, and it's overwhelming for people at times, but you know, we hold their hand. I have a lot of access points. I work with a nutritionist. We have accessibility for people to ask questions. So it is a lot of handholding in the beginning, but people feel, I was amazed at when I have a 4-week follow-up with people and I see the transformation they have by getting rid of the bad food. And within 4 weeks, people I've had taken care of before in my old practice, which took months or years to change their symptoms sometimes with meds alone, now are changing in 4 weeks. And that's the power of the diet. I think that's the power of kind of working on that microbiome and working on the gut. The other two reasons for working on the gut and the diet in the first place is that it also speaks to our immune system directly. And almost, you know, everything in medicine, every single illness in our medical textbooks has an inflammation component to it. And 80% of our immune system, which creates those cells, is in our gut. So we really want to start with the gut. And the third thing, the big thing for me in internal medicine with memory loss and all that, is the gut-brain connection. Serotonin and all the markers of inflammation that can get affected by our bad food choices, our bad lifestyle choices, then start to affect our brain, which can look like anxiety, depression, which are going through the roof right now with, you know, during these COVID times, as well as memory loss, which is quite frightening for a lot of people, right? At 40s, we can start having mild cognitive impairment. And that gut-brain connection is so powerful. And we have the ability to change our course and our pathway and our destiny for our health. And that's why I reiterate all that for people in the beginning so that they can get empowered to change. But it is a lot of handholding in the beginning. And but people and really foods, step up.
What foods do you find most inflammatory? Like when you said, I mean, soy and corn, you mentioned as far as GMO, but as far as inflammation, so, do you see wheat or dairy, or what is your biggest thing?
I use the elimination diet in the beginning for a lot of people because I don't have any information on them up front. So that includes the 8 most inflammatory foods that are considered by the allergists to be inflammatory. That's gluten, dairy, corn and soy, peanuts, shellfish, eggs, and beef. And so I don't have a sole plant-based diet, my plant-based community. My goal is to get people to be plant-based in general, but I don't start with that oftentimes. So we start with that elimination in the beginning, and then we work on things that restore them, like meditation and sleep and exercise and movement and fasting regimens that can help change that gut microbiome. And then I have people, you know, re-challenge, say, you know, corn and soy after a while, or other maybe nightshades or gluten back, and see how they do in terms of their symptoms. And oftentimes, you know, especially with dairy, they'll say, I really don't like the way I feel on it. And so we have that discussion of, you know, I think it's powerful to know what you feel like when you feel well. And then if you reintroduce it because you think you want to know for sure, a lot of people feel very badly on it. And then I try to transition them more and more into like more fiber, more, you know, talk more about nuts and seeds, and kind of veer them away of, you know, away from animal foods to more of a plant-based diet. But we have to start somewhere. And I often start with those 8 elimination.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Well, we're just about out of time. I'd like each of you to kind of like leave my listeners with one thing that you would recommend them trying to change. If you had one thing that you recommend to someone, what would that be? Dr. Monica, you want to go first?
Sure. So I guess first I would say to all the listeners, which I often will say at the end of a podcast, is that I think you have to, one of the things I want you to remember is that everything takes time. And
patience
and honor the body. You know, one of the things I say after my yoga practice is I'll say something like, accept what your body has to give and then push it further. And I would say that, you know, everything takes time. And so you're not going to be able to go from, because I get a lot of emails from, you know, listeners that say, well, how did you change and get better so fast? And I didn't. It took a lot of time and it took a lot of diligence and meticulousness to get better. And even then I have moments where I'm not perfect. And so the first thing, advice and comment I would say is to pick one thing and to try to do that one thing really well. Regarding food, I usually recommend first removing dairy, because I think dairy for me was very personally abnormal. It's such a trigger for me, but it won't always be dairy for everyone. But for many people, dairy will be an inflammatory trigger. Yeah. I told you, I think that would be the first thing to say is remove dairy and do it well. And yes, you'll be sad that you lost it or you took it out or lose your cheese. I mean, I used to eat 3 cheese sticks a day. Just take the time to do it and do it right and watch what happens to your body, but allow yourself the time and don't chastise yourself for what you do wrong, but embrace yourself for the things you do right.
Thank you. Thank you. And Dr. Jyoti?
Yes, one of the, I agree with all of what Monica said. I do think people need to be patient and forgive themselves, and it is a journey. One of the things I love to tell people about is fasting. The role of fasting, the diet and the information that's coming out is amazing. And so we overwhelmingly, I think, eat more than our body needs and necessitates. And again, for detox purposes, for rest purposes, our bodies need to rest. Our liver needs to rest. Our digestion needs to rest. So going for at least a 12-hour window of not eating and pushing that limit up to maybe fasting for 16 hours and eating in an 8-hour window is a really powerful intervention for insulin resistance, for changing your lipids, for lowering inflammation, lowering CRP, improving sleep, improving cognition. It has such potential for helping people. So I talk about that. I think that's one thing to consider is to increase your
intermittent fasting.
Yes, intermittent fasting to decrease our feeding windows.
Yeah.
And of course, you should talk to your physicians about it. There's definitely some conditions and medications that don't allow you to fast for long periods. So people should consult with their doctors. But I think most people could do a 12-hour fast where you're eating from, say, last meal at 7 p.m. and not eating till 7 a.m. in the morning for the first meal.
Yeah. And I think, and it's really easy to do. I've been doing that for a while now, and that's, you know, I love it. But I want to thank you both so much. This has been awesome. Your knowledge is wonderful. I love your book. I recommend everybody getting it, but we are out of time. So also check out my recipes and recommend to your patients my recipes, because I have, you know, since I've been vegan, all of them are vegan. You know, my older recipes from when I started are not all vegan, but over the last year, more than a year now, I've been 100% vegan, plant-based, and the recipe.
That'd be great. That'd be a great resource for our patients.
Check those out. And thank you so much, everyone. We've been talking with Dr. Monica Agrawal and Dr. Jyoti Rao, and I want to thank you both. And I will put their connections on my website so you can find out how to get in touch with them.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Everyone out there who's been joining us for this hour, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you all again next week. Have a great rest of the week and stay healthy. Bye for now.